Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, why are the state's fastest growing cities also the ones with the highest poverty? We'll take a look at the issue of poverty in Fresno and the rest of the valley in advance of a major event taking place tonight with Zocalo Public Square. Bill McEwen of the Fresno Bee will also join us, talking politics and his decision to stay in journalism after briefly announcing his retirement to enter the political world last week. And we'll learn how California's government transparency laws are coming up short in today's digital age. Plus, you won't want to miss it, we'll close the show with a trip to the fair to learn about the latest racing craze there this year. And here's a hint, it's not horses. But first, you probably noticed the near record high temperatures we're experiencing right now throughout Central California. The heat is especially a concern for those who work in the valley's fields. From 2000 to 2012, nearly 7,000 people were hospitalized in California for heat-related illnesses, and around 600 died. California now has the toughest workplace regulations in the nation when it comes to heat, but there's still a problem. Accurately measuring internal body temperature. Now, as FM89's Deanna Aguilera reports, new technology is allowing researchers to gain insights into the problem in the search for solutions.
It's early in the morning at UC Davis, and landscaper Willie Hernandez is about to take a pill for a medical study.
Like a vitamin pill, you know, kind of big because it's big and my vitamins are pretty big. I didn't have any problem with it. I mean, I swallow it pretty good. I don't feel anything. So as far as any effects, I don't feel anything.
But he's not swallowing a regular pill. It's actually a high-tech digital device used to measure internal body temperature. Researchers from UC Davis are hoping that with this new technology, they can have a better picture on how to prevent heat-related illnesses and deaths among agricultural workers. Mark Shanker is one of the lead researchers.
It's an amazing technology that has addressed a big problem, because before this, getting continuous, accurate body temperature was a real challenge. You couldn't do it.
Up until a few years ago, medical experts struggled on how to effectively measure body temperature in outdoor workers. In the past, they've tried ear or skin devices, but the sweat and movement from working all day made it hard to get accurate results. Shanker says in the last few years, this high-tech silicone capsule known as horse pill, because of its large size, has revolutionized the way people do research about this topic.
It's basically just like a vitamin pill that you swallow and a little receiver that gets a continuous signal of body temperature from that pill. And the pill is passed and not used again. That, we found, is the most accurate and reliable way to get core body temperature in these workers.
More than 500 farm workers throughout the state have participated in the study. Researchers have also done focus groups in Spanish and in indigenous languages, discussing how to protect workers' health in a high-heat environment. This time around, they're doing the same study on landscapers. Local doctors say in certain circumstances, knowing the exact core body temperature can be crucial. Susan Spano is with UCSF Fresno.
At the extreme ranges of temperature, knowing a core temperature is, say, above 107 would be very, very helpful in knowing the urgency of the situation, how quickly and how aggressive the measures are you need to cool the patient.
Back at UC Davis, research assistant Carlos Pina and I follow landscaper Willie Hernandez. It's a sunny, relatively cool day with a bit of wind.
You see how this ivy has been all on the wall? So what I want to do is at least get this off here and maybe a little bit around the trees.
While Hernandez is pruning away, Pina is taking notes. He says writing down the landscaper's activities is an important part of the research.
We can better explain certain data. So, for example, if we see like a big dip within their core body temperature, and we write down, like, oh, at 10:22 a.m., they drank water, then we can explain why there was a dip.
After the landscapers finish their shift, the researchers download the data sent from the pill the workers swallowed earlier that day. The capsule is FDA-approved and one-time use only. Pina says it's the least invasive way known to measure core body temperature.
It's completely safe. We have used it over 500 participants in the last 3 years. We've never had an issue. And this pill has been used in other research projects. No other agencies have worked with military and firefighters, and they have ingested this pill as well.
This is the first in-depth study of heat illness among agricultural workers in California. Researchers hope to create new prevention strategies for both the workers and farmers when they present their findings next year. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Diana Aguilera.
This is Valley Edition. You may have noticed a trend in the news as of late. Here's three items. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's infamous private email server, Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson suing a local newspaper seeking to stop the release of emails he and other city staff sent, and locally, the recent CyberDust secret text messaging scandal at the Fresno Unified School District. All examples of the gap between public records laws and the new ways we communicate. Fresno Unified Superintendent Michael Hansen has admitted to asking his senior administrators to use the CyberDust app to communicate with each other on school district business for a brief time in 2014. The app's main feature? It sends and receives encrypted messages that are instantly deleted after they're read, without leaving a trace. Now open government advocates are asking a big question. Are we entering a new age of government officials using technology to hide from public scrutiny? Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports it's difficult for lawmakers to keep up with the rapid pace of technological change.
As communications technology has raced forward at breakneck speed, it has left public access to vital documents in the dust. That's the assessment of some open government advocates who say the law has not kept up with the times. Emily Shaw works with the Sunlight Foundation, a nonprofit that calls for greater government transparency. She finds the very existence of the secret text messaging app CyberDust and its use by public officials to be a big warning sign.
Pretty obvious that in order to have to run a democracy, we need to operate on the principle that our governments are operating in the public interest and operate with public oversight.
California public record law allows for the media and ordinary citizens to access information about what public officials are doing in their name. It's been used to uncover corruption and scandals, like the case of Bell California, where officials personally enriched themselves with public funds. California does consider electronic records like text and email to be covered under its Freedom of Information laws, but does not prescribe any requirement for maintaining those records. It also leaves in question the messages sent from privately owned devices and email accounts. Shaw says this is a concern because apps that help hide information are rapidly proliferating, and CyberDust might just be the tip of the iceberg.
You know, there's a number of services out there that are working to achieve this goal of making electronic communications disappear immediately. So, you know, this is a goal that, you know, clearly there's a market for. And so I anticipate that this will not be the end.
Valley Public Radio decided to compare Fresno Unified's public records retention policies with other large school districts and the city of Fresno. It turns out Fresno's guidelines are more comprehensive than other districts, but all policies leave gaps. San Diego Unified School District, for example, has no blanket policy guiding employee record keeping at all. Los Angeles Unified has a policy covering email, which they keep for a year, but there's no mention of other electronic communications, such as text or instant messaging. Fresno's policy is slightly more comprehensive, covering any district-owned electronic device that can send or receive messages. However, they too only keep emails for 1 year and are not required to save text messages at all. That's why Superintendent Hansen says the use of CyberDust did not violate district policy, because there's no requirement to save text messages despite their prevalence in everyday life. Superintendent Hansen did not respond to multiple requests for comment on this story. And as for the city of Fresno, city spokesman Mark Standriff says they do not have the technical ability to save all text, but that it is their policy to consider any electronic communication including text and social media posts, to be subject to open records laws. Emily Shaw with the Sunlight Foundation says this exposes the glaring holes in state law.
But, you know, this area where we're talking about messaging services, you know, on cell phones or on other devices that may not actually be publicly held is an entirely new set of questions for lawmakers to work on.
CyberDust's primary financial backer is billionaire investor and television star Mark Cuban. In an email conversation with Valley Public Radio, Cuban defended the existence of the app, saying it's no different than if two public officials have a face-to-face conversation that leaves no trace. Cuban said the privacy can create honesty, and quote, "In this day and age, every email, text, tweet, or post has to be written with a concern about how it could be misused by the media, as an example. CyberDust prevents that problem. You can communicate exactly what you're thinking." What is and isn't required to be kept for public access is a matter of legal wrangling in California. A case is currently before the state Supreme Court to determine if messages sent from private email accounts or personal devices like cell phones are searchable under open records law. Also, whether text messaging and other electronic communication should be treated the same as paper records, with mandatory record maintenance periods. Peter Scheer with the First Amendment Coalition says even though the law is murky, apps like CyberDust push the boundaries.
And the staff were directed to use an application whose sole purpose is to destroy all traces of the communication that they have. I would think that they are skating on legally thin ice.
He says it's becoming clearer every day that the law is simply no longer able to do what it was created for, which is to shine a light into public business.
What's the point, after all, of a Public Records Act or a Freedom of Information law if there is no stored information, if there are no records to provide copies of in response to requests under that act?
That's a question many more Californians could be asking themselves going forward. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
And here to join us more to talk about that issue, government transparency, and other things on the agenda, as well as his own future in journalism, we have Bill McEwen, editorial page editor with the Fresno Bee, on the phone with us now. Bill, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you, Joe. Glad to be on.
Bill, for that last story that Jeffrey produced, we invited Superintendent Hansen to participate. We wanted his comments. He did not respond to our repeated requests. But in other comments to the media in regards to the CyberDust scandal, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, the response was, what's the big deal? What is the big deal in your view?
Well, I mean, as I stated in the column that I wrote, Joe, taxpayers pay the bills. They pay the freight, and taxpayers have a right to know what's going on. So it's no more complicated than that. And, you know, Mark Cuban operates in the private world. He wants to use CyberDust in his private dealings. That's fine. Just listening to what was on the air before I came on, though, I mean, he talked about how the media might get a hold of these things and misuse it. You notice that Mr. Cuban never brought up that someone might use his app to mislead the public. He didn't bring up the other side of the coin. And, you know, our position at the Fresno Bee has always been that the more sunlight you can shine on government, the better. And I would note that you have Sam Blakeslee, who's the former Senate Republican leader, Charles Munger. They filed an initiative with the Attorney General to increase government transparency. I think they did that yesterday, and this is backed by California Forward. Doesn't have anything to do with technology, but they're asking, again, that lawmakers and the public have at least 72 hours to review a bill before a final vote. And, Joe, you know what happens in the final days of the legislature.
Gut and amend.
There's all kinds of horse trading. They do use gut and amend, which is take a bill that has a title like We're for the People Act and then put something else in there entirely. And the public never gets to see it. Defenders of this practice say that well, you need that last minute surge. You need that last minute urgency. Otherwise, you would never get anything done in Sacramento. And I would counter that by saying anything worth doing is worth doing right. And we'd have a lot fewer bad bills and many fewer unintended consequences if legislators set a schedule, fully reviewed things, held hearings, and then had their vote in the light of day instead of 1:30 a.m. on the last day.
Back at the local level, even if we take Superintendent Hansen at his word that this was just an experiment in trying to be more efficient in the office that was abandoned shortly after it started, doesn't it, though, raise the perception that, you know, what does the district have to hide? Why is this push for secrecy and making sure that these communications aren't preserved? Does that speak highly of the administration there in that regard, in your view?
Well, I don't think they should have been using CyberDust or any, type of apparatus or application that, gets rid of messages as soon as you can view them. I don't think that's a good thing. Now, was the superintendent doing this just as a trial to test out an app? Only he knows that. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to make a comment on that.
Again, Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee with us today on Valley Edition, talking about a number of different things in the world of local politics. In fact, you yourself wound up in the news last week in a very unexpected fashion, at least unexpected for many of your readers. On Monday, late Monday afternoon, you announced that you would be leaving the Bee to enter the political world as district director for Jim Costa. Then later in the week, that was off. Walk us through the process there and how you followed through on those decisions and then reverse yourself.
Well, Joe, you said unexpected. You could add uncomfortable, too, if you want a little alliteration to that. My intention was to retire from journalism, and basically, as I ended up writing later in the week, I wanted to leave the Bee just the way I went in, which was basically unknown. I came to work.
Did you really think that would happen?
Well, silly me. that was my goal, and I'm not one that seeks the spotlight. I like doing the work, but that was my goal, and so I had a total misread. And the Bee made a big deal about it, and I got all this response, overwhelming response from people, text, email, Twitter, all those kinds of things. A lot of people say nice things about me. That was unexpected. And then many people saying, don't leave. Don't leave the Bee. We don't want you to leave the Bee. Now, it's my personal choice, but how can that not affect someone? And at that time, it caused me to reevaluate the situation. The other thing is that district director's job typically is for someone who's young, has a long future ahead of them in politics, and I got to thinking about that, driving all over the district, very big area. I got two grandkids that I love. My wife adores them, and really started thinking about the number of hours and the number of days a week you would be working to serve Representative Costa in the best possible manner. And so it was that, and then also combined with people saying that, the platform of the editorial page of the Bee still wields a lot of power. Along with that power comes a lot of responsibility, and that I could have a bigger impact on people's lives if I stayed at the Bee. And, Joe, quite honestly, there was an example of that. We've had a hard time in the Eastern District of the federal court getting enough judges there to handle the caseload. I know the Valley Public Radio has talked about the big caseload for this court and given some of the reasons. One of them is, we have so many prisons in our area, and inmates file a lot of federal lawsuits. They challenge a lot of things. Many times, you know, these are not serious suits, but they still have to be dealt with. Sometimes they are very serious and raise constitutional issues and the like. And then we just have the course of business in our area, and we don't have enough judges. And so John Ellis had written a story talking about the Senate was in gridlock. It appeared that there was a Republican strategy of not confirming judges this year. We know that they're not going to be confirming federal judges in an election year. We wrote an editorial saying, wait a second, you're supposed to do the people's work. The judge that has been nominated is not controversial in any way, shape, or form. We reminded Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that he had promised that the Senate under him would govern, and we wrote that editorial. We also know that Senator Barbara Boxer weighed in. But anyway, about an hour after I, you know, announced this change, here came word that the judge had been approved. So in my thinking, it showed that even in this diluted media age that newspapers are still listened to by policymakers and people in elected office.
Do you see your role at the Beat changing at all, still retaining your title as editorial page editor? Are you going to be writing more columns under your own byline, perhaps, in the future?
Yes, you know, that's my goal. We have, you know, a big digital push. I've been very involved in that. I see that role lessening somewhat. I see some of the administrative responsibilities lessening, and my goal is to write more columns and write columns about issues that affect people's lives, and in those columns lay out what the problem is, lay out possible solutions, and also spell out how people can get directly involved.
Bill McEwen with us today on Valley Edition. I want to circle around to another local issue that gained national attention, huge national attention last week, and that's the surprise, the quick rise and surprisingly quick fall of Kevin McCarthy's bid to be the next Speaker of the House. Have you ever seen anything quite like that, in at least in recent memory?
Well, I think the stage was set a little bit. I mean, you know, people were saying that Kevin McCarthy is the front runner, but they were also saying, you know, this is politically, this is a crazy time on the Republican side, and that, you know, you could always kind of expect the unexpected. The surprise came to me because it looked like he had gelled the support and people were behind him, and then, you know, he made the announcement. Of course, there's an accompanying storyline that, you know, people are whispering that he had an affair with another member of Congress, and that member and Kevin McCarthy have vehemently denied it. I'm sure there'll be a lot of investigative reporting going on. And in today's world, it may not be the Washington Post, the New York Times, or Politico that gets to the bottom of that. You know, it may be TMZ, or it could be the National Enquirer, the way it was with Senator Edwards. So what we have now with that situation, for the Valley, it's a loss, because as Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy would have been in position to help the Valley on some issues. And, you know, this is a powerful position. And it would have been good for California. It would have been especially good for the Valley. So that's unfortunate because, as you know, Joe, the Valley has many very real needs. And oftentimes we're overlooked. We don't get equity with the way politics is played in Washington, D.C., or the way it's played in Sacramento.
Looking again at the local implications of a national issue, is there a local split or a significant local split, do you think, in the Republican Party? You have prominent conservatives here in this area speaking out critically against, of all people, Devin Nunes, who's pretty solidly conservative most of the time, a pretty red Republican, and some of his comments about other members of the House Freedom Caucus. Do you see local Republicans reflecting the national split in the party in that way?
Well, I do, because Devin Nunes and Kevin McCarthy are, you know, John Boehner proteges. They're in his camp, and they are conservative. But they also have the experience of government. They also have a worldview and life experiences that, you know, you have to make compromises on occasions. And they also are realistic enough to know how government works. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is they could accomplish all their goals if they had the presidency. Right now, they control Congress. They dominate the House of Representatives. They have slight control of the Senate. The Senate, as you know, Joe, you know, when it's fairly close in there, you know, sometimes it can still be difficult to get your legislation through there. But they solidly control Congress. They don't have the presidency. Elections have consequences. If the Republicans had won the presidency, they would be able to enact many of these things, and Tea Party people would be happy. But you have this faction in the Republican Party that on everything wants to go to political war, you know, defund the government, you know, try and break President Obama. What they don't understand is President Obama, when you're the president, you don't break the president.
Yeah, we aren't in a parliamentary system.
The president is going to work with Republicans on bills that are of mutual interest. And so this whole Tea Party wing, a lot of it's on emotion. It's not realistic, and it's just based in this belief that on every issue, you know, you grind government to a halt. And when you grind government to a halt, that's not a good thing. As we know, you know, what it costs the economy when you had the government shut down in 2013, and also the very real effect on people's lives. So, you know, this is a tough issue. And the other thing is, in these Tea Party districts, they are so gerrymandered that, you know, they don't have to worry about the consequences of elections.
Well, I think that's something that many political factions share beyond the Tea Party as well. Again, Bill McEwen with us today, editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee, recently announced his plans to remain in the journalism world after an announcement last Monday that he would be leaving to be district director rather for Jim Costa, Democratic congressman from Fresno. Bill McEwen, thank you so much for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Thank you, Joe.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and talk to Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square about an event coming up tonight around poverty in Fresno. How can Fresno solve its poverty problem? We'll get Joe Matthews' perspectives as well as some local residents' views on the issue. Sharon Mua will join us, and also an anthropologist from UC Davis who's studying these issues. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Joining us now on the telephone, we have a guest from Zocalo Public Square. He writes the Connecting California program for Zocalo Public Square. His column appears in newspapers across the state and on the web, and Joe joins us now. He's written about this issue. Joe Matthews, welcome to Valley Edition.
Great to be with you, Joe.
Joe, I want to start with you and this column that you wrote last week about poverty in Fresno, inland California, essentially. And you point out this paradox that makes this area very different than most other areas that we think of across the country when we think of high poverty. Explain what you're talking about there.
Well, you know, I as a young reporter, was a reporter in Baltimore, where I watched the population decline by big numbers every year. Very poor city with a lot of challenges. You know, the same is true. You see population declines in lots of poor cities in the Northeast and in the Rust Belt, but even in some parts of the sort of the Upper South. We think of poor places as places that people want to get out of. But when you look at California, not just Fresno, but a lot of cities that are poor cities, you see growth in population. Even San Bernardino and Stockton, which have both declared bankruptcy, have grown in population as they went into bankruptcy and as they come out of it. That's interesting, and it's one way in which California is different.
Is that something that you think people should take some hope in, or is it maybe perhaps even more concerning? Does that mean that the population of people living in poverty is growing all that much faster, or does it mean that there's opportunity in these areas for upward mobility that you wouldn't maybe have in some of these more depressed, as you mentioned, Rust Belt areas or New Orleans and the Lower Ninth Ward, those types of areas that also have huge concentrated urban poverty?
I think it's both. I mean, I think it's dangerous to make generalizations about poor people, because there are all kinds of different poor people, different backgrounds, different stages of their lives, going in different directions. But certainly, it says problematic things about some of the wealthy areas of our state, how hard it is to sort of stay there and make it there, our failures to do things like, you know, build transit and affordable housing, particularly on the coast. But, you know, what we're seeing when you look at how people move in and out of California and around California is the large group of people departing the state. The people on the move are the people making less than $30,000 a year. Some of them are going to state. A lot are going to Texas. The people going to Texas from California are a lot poorer than those going to places like Arizona and Nevada closer. But some people are going to a place like Fresno, and for the same reason, that you go to Texas. You're looking for a place in the old manner of California where you can sort of show up and have a better quality of life, can have a better standard of living. That's why people came to California. So, you know, I think for a fair number of poor folks coming to a place like Fresno, there is a sense that Fresno is a sort of California's California, in the way that California used to be America's America, a kind of place you go to for another chance. When things have been too hard someplace else.
Now, I want to get into the question of why in a second and bring in some of our other guests. But before we do that, you have an event coming up tonight in Fresno to talk about this this issue. And I'm actually going to be the moderator for this. But, Joe, I'll give you the honors of telling us what's exactly coming up tonight and who are the panelists participating in this Zocalo Public Square event.
Well, we have a It's a panel includes the mayor of Fresno, some other folks from business and community, and sort of technology, from Earl Gwynn to Pete Weber to Cruz Avila. The question is, can Fresno win the war on poverty? That's a bit of a provocation.
As you are sometimes want to do with Zocalo.
What's that? Yes, but given that, we do that sometimes, but given that, the stakes are, I think, high for Fresno to, and lots of other cities in California, all of us, to do better by people in poverty. And I think Fresno is actually, contrary to some of the debate we heard in the most recent gubernatorial election, a lot of people are doing a lot of thinking and a lot of work in Fresno around the subject in a lot of different ways, and I think the goal is really to, in a little bit more than an hour, get a sense of what that picture is.
And I want to bring in one of those people who's doing some of that work right now with us in the studio. We have Shur Mua. He is with the Boys and Men of Color program with Fresno Building Healthy Communities. Shur, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me.
And your group is essentially focused on issues of health, but you take this much further beyond just making sure people are getting their checkups and things like that. How do you see the health of residents being affected by the communities that they live in and issues like poverty?
Right. So we see health as a poverty issue, and you're right. People are affected by where they live in the communities. And we see that when the cities invest in those communities, like with parks, with having enough park space for residents, parks that are clean, but also having good schools for students to attend where they can achieve success, that are where their parents are involved, but also healthcare. Like you said, with healthcare, not just getting healthcare, but getting preventive healthcare. Because when folks get preventive healthcare, that means that they're getting their checkups. That means that they're not having to wait until they get sick to go to the ER. So health happens in these communities.
What do you think is one thing that we're doing really well right now in making an impact on this problem, and then maybe one area where we aren't really doing well and whatever we're doing is not working?
I think one of the things that we're doing well is we're engaging residents. We're getting residents. We're talking to residents. We're hearing their voices. We're bringing their voices and their concerns up. And I think that's addressing. For example, one of the things that's happening in the schools is the local control funding formula. And one of that is that that's bringing in money for lower income students, English learners, and foster youth. But we're also a part of that is engaging parents in their students' education, because we see that when parents are engaged in students' education, that leads to student success. So I think that's one of the things that we're doing well. And Fresno Building Healthy Communities and its partners, like Fresno Center for New Americans, are working on that.
And I want to turn back to Joe Matthews now. You asked a number of people, experts, local, national, to weigh in on this issue. And people who visit kvpr.org can actually find this article on our website. You published this piece. We called it How Can Fresno End Poverty? What did you hear from the people that you spoke with?
A variety of different things, but some of the big themes are literally getting people's cash into people's hands, getting people health care, getting people education, and really it's a sense of sort of stakeholding that, you've seen this in studies of crime, that actually cash payments in certain places can reduce crime because people have something to hold on to. It's an incentive to have a stake, to participate and do sort of other things. Education does that, having health care does that, there's all other ways sort of to create a stake and a sense of, being poor is not a, it's not like being blonde, right, or having blue eyes. It's a condition that can change and often does change. People, there's a lot of change in people's lives and economic prospects, that sense of having stakes, a sense of the future, of being able to plan, having a control over one's life, to sort of plan for things in the long term. I mean, that's sort of where people want to go. I think that's something that sort of covers all the answers we got in that feature.
I want to bring in another voice to our conversation, and one that is newsworthy for a couple of reasons, not only because Zocalo is doing this event on poverty in Fresno, but new data released last week as part of a study, a collaboration between the Institute for Public Anthropology at Fresno State and researchers at UC Davis about the number of Valley youth that aren't employed and aren't enrolled in school. One of the study participants or directors, M. Ann Visser from UC Davis, joins us now. Ann, welcome to Valley Edition.
Oh, thank you, Joe.
Your study is really eye-opening. Your report shows that as many as 17.1% of San Joaquin Valley youth are not enrolled in school or employed. That compares with 8.2% of adults in California. Is that number as potentially, I should perhaps just say it, frightening as it appears, looking at that?
Yes, it does, and frightening is exactly the correct word, because actually, in reality, we do know the limitations of census data, particularly at the county level. These official estimates, likely based upon national trends, are grossly underestimating the rate of disconnection from school and work for young people between the ages of 16 to 24. So we're actually probably looking at rates that are 20% or higher.
So exactly what does that mean? What are the implications there? And how does that work in the research that you've looked at?
Sure. So, it's implications, because we do know young people between the ages of 16 to 24 are going through what we call the transition to adulthood. And we generally equate a transition to adulthood with the successful attainment of gainful full-time employment in the labor market. We do know that after the Great Recession, the youth labor market in particular was particularly hit hard. It's at its lowest rate of employment since the BLS in the United States began to gather this type of data. We also know that there are projections from the BLS that have come out that have suggested that the youth labor market will never actually retain its full-time employment rate that it had prior to 2007. And it's really important, because when you really think about the first job that young people get in the labor market, it really sets the path and the course for their overall lifetime economic opportunity. So the fact that you have young people who are not in school, which would increase their human hospital and basically increase their competitiveness in the labor market to get a better job, so to speak. And also the number of young people who aren't even able to attach to employment, meaning that they're staying out of the labor market longer. The immediate impact, of course, is issues of subsistence and increase in poverty rates across the valley, but the long-term impact is long-term poverty, long-term social implications, and long-term social costs. So combined with the national forecast and the valley's current economic climate, this really is sort of the perfect storm brewing on the horizon to really challenge sort of youth economic prospects in the valley for all youth, not just those who are disconnected, but those who are in the labor market themselves.
You mentioned that the numbers here in the valley are much worse than the state as a whole. Are there other parts of the state that are faring as bad as Fresno? I don't know if you have that data in front of you, but the Inland Empire and San Bernardino counties faces
right.
a lot of the same challenges. Are they seeing similar numbers like that, or is this Central Valley area, San Joaquin Valley area, just off the charts by itself?
I mean, so the San Joaquin Valley data is suggested to be comparable with sort of areas like the Inland Empire. It's also comparable and a little lower than areas like L.A. or San Francisco and other work that I've done in other big mega cities like New York, Baltimore, Chicago, L.A. I mean, they're showing rates of disconnection as high as 20%. Now, you can't really compare youth disconnection rates in the valley with youth disconnection rates in sort of urban city centers like Chicago and New York because it's a much different environment. What we do know is that these rates are particularly high for rural areas, looking at national trends, and suburban areas. And so this is pointing to the fact that there's something unique in the San Joaquin Valley, and it could be a temporary thing, the impact of the recession. It could be a long-term thing, sort of a lack of labor market growth, the way in which the economy is diversifying and the recovery, a question about the quality of jobs or the types of jobs coming back in the labor market. And all of this is sort of what we're seeking to try to figure out. But it's very difficult because within formal national data sets, data on San Joaquin Valley and the San Joaquin Valley youth is almost invisible. This is the first time we've been able to get this data down to the county level. And so it's really hard to understand this without going into the field and talking to these young people and talking to the people who work with these young people, which is what we're getting ready to do in our study right now.
And when will that be complete?
So the ethnographic fieldwork, which is the part that we are partnering with the Institute for Public Anthropology, will be complete next fall. We're beginning to deploy, for lack of a better term, our team of social scientists, which includes students from both UC Davis and from Fresno State, into Valley communities to talk to a variety of state and nonprofit organizations that work with these young people, as well as disconnected youth themselves and youth who are in the labor market and in school, to talk about sort of the transitions to adulthood, what exactly they do to find jobs, how they find jobs, what are their challenges, and how do these organizations serve these young people. It's important because the only thing we do know in the research is that disconnected youth in rural areas, like other impoverished communities in rural areas, are basically underserved by a variety of federal and state programs. And so what happens then is it falls onto local programs to serve these communities. And we do know that there are issues of capacity and access in rural areas, but we haven't been yet able to put our finger on what exactly that is. And so we're trying to identify sort of these connections and these challenges to identify, of course, the possibilities that exist within these challenges as well.
I want to bring Ashur Mua from Boys and Men of Color and Building Healthy Communities back into this conversation. In what you see on the street, does that back up what the research that we're seeing from Aman Visser tells us? Are you seeing the same thing, that disconnected youth and the connection with poverty?
We are seeing that. We're hearing that from our young people who are living in these neighborhoods that have not been invested in. Where they live, where they go to school, where they play in the parks, there's been a disinvestment here in Fresno and these communities, and that has been some of the challenges that they're coming up against because just of the lack of investment.
One of the big issues with your organization is, and you mentioned it briefly already, is access to parks.
Right.
That is a big, long-term, big-ticket thing, or at least according to the city, that's what they will say.
Right.
When it comes to turning things around, is it a matter of, in your view, big projects, like opening up a big new regional park, Or are there smaller things that can be done? Because when we're looking at equality in neighborhoods and having a neighborhood where it's safe to go outside and exercise and those sorts of things, it plays a big part in the health of an overall neighborhood, both physically and also economically. Is this just a big picture issue in your view, or are there small things that can be done?
I think there's both. I think we're in full support of Parks for All. So when something like the regional parks, I think something we can support. But also, I think there's the Parks Master Plan, which is coming up, right? But also an investment in parks, investments in parks that are in Fresno, bringing those parks up to code, making sure that they're clean, that they're safe places to play. So I think it's definitely both.
I want to turn now back to Joe Matthews with Zocalo Public Square on the phone. Joe, so much of California's attention is centered on the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, also centered on the L.A. metro area. With issues like poverty, you write about the Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, and the Inland Empire. Is Sacramento finally getting the attention, or are these areas finally getting the attention of Sacramento? Or is this something that needs to be addressed, in your view, at the local level, and maybe that's not the best route?
I think there's a tension in some ways more now, but you know, I'm not sure that attention is all the poverty. You hear it in things more like the drought and high-speed rail bringing attention. I do think the fundamental problem in California is we are such a centralized governance system. And, you know, our local communities and even, you know, quite big cities. And Fresno, people there know it, but people in the rest of the city don't understand. Fresno is a big city with over 500,000 people. You know, it's a significant American city, and it needs to be much more in control of its own destiny. But our whole governance structure is highly centralized. And I just think that to address a, you know, really, you know, diverse and complex problem like poverty, you know, our local, our counties, our cities need much more in terms of resources and also sort of power, flexibility, discretion to do what they need to do. You know, I think that's true across problems beyond poverty. Our problems are more complex. They require sort of more local knowledge, more flexibility, more coalition building, you know, now. And we just don't have that in California. And that's a profound problem that touches so many things.
Joe Matthews is from Zocalo Public Square. The organization presents a free event tonight at 7 o'clock at the, well, Frank's Place at the Warner Center for the Performing Arts. It's called Can Fresno Win the War on Poverty? Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen, Pete Weber of Fresno Bridge Academy and California Forward, and Cruz Avila of the Pavarello House will be on the panel. You're welcome to attend. You can find more information at zocalopublicsquare.org. We'd like to thank Joe as well as Shur Mua from Boys and Men of Color and M. Ann Visser for joining us today. This is Valley Edition. The Big Fresno Fair is known for live horse racing. Every year, thousands flock to watch jockeys and their steeds compete at the fair. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, horses aren't the only animals tearing up soil for a chance at the grand prize this year.
They're up at the Big Fresno Fair. Had a very fast beginning for Bad News Bubba. Shoe Fly broke alertly, and the two favorites are absolutely dominating.
If you want to bet on a horse race at the Big Fresno Fair, it's an easy thing to do. Tickets are $2 and races are short. That's why thousands of people fill the stands at the fairgrounds for beer and the age-old practice of horse racing. Steve Trustner is one of this year's spectators.
Pick a good-looking horse, the favorite, and the one in orange, and box them in on a $2 bet, cost me $12 a race. Every now and then you get lucky.
They're exciting animals. They run 32 miles an hour. They're fast, 1,000 pounds. You got to get down close to the animals. All the racing is the same. Horse racing, car racing, when you're close to it, you feel the enthusiasm.
That's Larry Swartzlander, the California Authority of Racing Fans.
Bad News Bubba, head and head for the wire. Shoe Fly or Bad News Bubba. Bad News Bubba prevails.
But horse racing isn't the only race that has fans oohing and aahing at the fair this year. Think pigs, pooches, sheep, and even turkeys. But unlike horse races, people don't officially gamble on the outcome. Nancy and Gil Riegler from San Diego are racing the birds most known for Thanksgiving dinners, turkeys.
Hi, guys!
So racing turkeys is a thing?
No. totally kidding.
I'm like,
we just do it because it's so funny. And turkeys are unexpectedly exuberant. They're very innocent. They're competitive.
They got the idea after California Fair organizers asked them to integrate turkeys into their routine. The couple thought, why not have the giant birds compete, since fairgoers seem to love any type of racing?
Part of the allure is you don't know the outcome, and we like to be surprised. And even though, yeah, we know they're going to race, oh, I didn't know that was going to happen. Oh, what an upset. I didn't know, you know, Blue was going to win this time because something happened on the track.
But how do they get turkeys to race? The Rieglers fill a bed of a remote-controlled truck with turkey food, and then they're off.
Here we go. Go get them, boys. Cheer on your team. It looks like it's going to be between the red and the blue.
A turkey from the white team jumped the middle divider and caught the remote control truck.
How about the red team? We give it to them this race. Very nice. Oh, careful now.
The turkeys race three times a day in a small stadium near the carnival rides at the fair. On the other side of the fairgrounds, little pigs leap over hurdles to the finish line.
On your marks. Get set. And go! And they're off.
These miniature porkers are part of a traveling pig squad run by the Knoll family from Eugene, Oregon. The All-Alaskan pig races began over 25 years ago. Four pigs, mostly Yorkshire and Hampshire varieties, race at a time with four different heats in each show.
Oh my goodness, folks, that was a close race, but it looks like Sloppy Joe took the win out here.
Amber Nelson and her student Nevia Reese watched the little pigs race to the finish line to collect their prize, sweet molasses rich feed.
I thought it was fun. They were super cute. They were a lot faster than I thought they were going to be, and I didn't expect them to jump either.
These cute little pig runners and gobbling racers at the Big Fresno Fair will be joined by friendly pooches Saturday, October 17th. Locals can sign up online and race their backyard canines for the annual Derby Dog Dash. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or you can send us a tweet. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. You can also find us on Instagram, @Valley Public Radio, for those online photo sharing fans. You can visit our website and find podcasts and more, audio archives, all of our past reports from Valley Edition. It's all on the web at kvpr.org, and check up on all the local news that our team produces. For our local news team, Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Jeffrey Hess, and reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.